Hello everyone and welcome to episode 5 of Nevermind the Dambusters. This episode is part 2 of the Wuppertal raid, Firestorm. We should warn you that this episode contains descriptions of historical events which some listeners may find distressing. So James, what have you been up to over the last few days and since we last spoke?
Yeah, a few things. I've actually been working on a proposal for the RAF Museum Conference in September and found out I've been accepted. So that's very, very exciting. I also visited Earl's Cone Airfield, which is near Colchester, which was lovely. It's a lovely little working airfield. There's a museum there. And I'm looking to visit Boxted, that I've been to a few times, another local airfield. Otherwise, it's been endless marking of essays and such like. But yeah, what about you, Joan?
I went spent the weekend at the International Bomber Command Centre in Lincoln at a conference on writing the air war. And it was absolutely fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. There were so many sort of academics, professors there, but ordinary people as well. And there were so many interesting stories and interesting perspectives and dealing with issues around memorialisation, all sorts of stuff. It was absolutely brilliant. And we had added Aurora, of course, and we even had a Spitfire fly past. What more could you want?
Oh, fantastic.
It was the perfect weekend. It really was.
Maybe a hurricane, now, I would say.
Well, oh yeah, you would say a hurricane.
What more could you ask for, a hurricane or a blenheim?
That was never going to happen.
Well, yeah.
It was lovely, though. No, the weather was gorgeous and the food was great. And I met some really, really interesting people, including some Caribbean veterans who were absolutely fantastic.
Oh, fantastic.
And absolutely hilarious. I think they were 99 and 98. They were absolutely brilliant.
Wow.
Really, really good fun.
Brilliant.
So let's get down to business then. And we are now going to begin the second installment of the story of the Wuppertal raid of May 1943. Now, last time we talked about Bomber Command strategy in 1943, how targets were selected and what happened on individual bases when operations were announced. The raid that we're focusing on is Wuppertal, 29th to 30th of May, 1943. It's not particularly well known, nor has it been discussed in any great detail by historians in the past. We've chosen this raid for precisely that reason. There was nothing unusual about it, at least not as far as Bomber Command was concerned.
At the end of part one, we left the crews of 10 Squadron, one of many squadrons taking part in the raid, on the runway and the perimeter track, awaiting for their turn to take off. Now, you'll recall that we introduced you to two crews, that of Reg Pennicott, known to his crew as Penny, the self-styled Penny's Prangers, in Halifax, Waiorka, and that of New Zealander John Clark in S. Sugar, just two of 719 crews detailed for this operation. Of those, 611 bombers would drop their high explosives on Barman that night. Although the two pilots had flown a second pilot on two operations earlier that week, for each of their crews, this was their first operation. Now, taking off for a raid, I mean, yeah, we've talked about the nerves. Can you imagine on your first op as well, you're going to be nervous, you're not going to really know what to expect. You might have spoken to other crews and experienced pilots and such like. There's only so much that training can teach you as well. And you don't know what your first stop is going to be, of course, until a few hours before you're going to take off. So the anxiety over, is it going to be a long trip? Is it going to be very far? Is also playing with the mind of whether they would come back. What really, you know, had they warned their crews what they were in for, or did they play it down? Was it just that this is the first off, let's get on with it? Was there that little bit of excitement as well, perhaps, getting a chance to finally see some action? We don't really know, do we?
We touched on this at the conference last weekend about the pilots who'd been on sort of the two preliminary training operations, if you like. What would they have actually said to their crews? And the general consensus was that they wouldn't have warned them how bad it actually was, and that they probably said, it'll be fine, you'll be all right, kind of thing. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? Yeah, you know, you just can't even begin to think about it, really, can you?
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's just a case of focusing on the job. That's all you can do at the time, and making sure you don't sort of make a mistake or anything. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So at precisely 11 p.m., Y Yorker receives the signal light from the controller's caravan at the end of the runway. Penny gives the four Merlin engines full throttle and Y Yorker hurtles down the runway and up into the night. Just 2 minutes later, S Sugar takes off next in line, and soon all 16 10 Squadron crews are airborne, heading south to the assembly point at Orford Ness on the Suffolk coast to take their position in the bomber stream. James, do you just want to give us a bit of an idea about what a bomber stream actually is and how it all worked?
Yeah, so the bombing stream really is about overwhelming the enemy defences. Before you had the bombing stream, you had bombers flying individually, charting, they'd reach waypoints to try and dodge defences and such like and see landmarks underneath. And at this point, the Luftwaffe are flying with single fighters in the Kammhuber line in boxes. Well, there's usually one or two fighters in these boxes. And this is also about just absolutely overwhelming that, as well as the defences on the ground. You now also have G, the navigational aid, so there's no need for the dead reckoning. There is navigational help now. And, I mean, the flying over had to be timed in intervals when it came to a stream to avoid collision. You imagine that many bombers going over all at once. It had to be timed to the second taking off and such like. And the stream itself actually meant for a shorter bombing time. So where raids in the early part of the war could take a few hours, maybe 4 hours, now they were taking place in an hour, 90 minutes, which meant for a maximum hit onto the target. And it also meant that the services and emergency services, as well as the defences on the ground, were absolutely overwhelmed. And it was so successful that it's used till the end of the war. It really is a maximum hit effort, this idea of the bombing stream. So the first aircraft anticipated to be over the target on returning to the night, codenamed Sprod, at 12:45 a.m., many of them had taken off long before the 10 Squadron crews. Now, it's not a long way to the Ruhr Valley, really, not that far beyond the Dutch border, in the northwestern corner of Germany.
So what's happening on board Y Yorker? Well, the crews would be basically checking their equipment, checking their wireless, checking their intercoms. The navigator would be calculating and recalculating his targets. The wireless operator will be sending test signals every half an hour or so, just back to base. The bomb aimer is going to be working on his calculations, checking and rechecking them. The flight engineer, always the busiest man on board the aircraft, would be checking the fuel, checking the hydraulic fluids, checking the engines. Basically, he's constantly on his feet, running up and down, checking, make sure that everything is functioning as it should do. Now, as they approach the target area, the crew of Y Yorker would have been unaware that three of the squadron's aircraft, the Pinkerton, Sutton and Brunton crews, had already had to drop out of the bomber stream and attempt to return to base due to technical problems even before they reached the enemy coast. And that certainly wasn't an uncommon phenomenon. Quite often, a handful of any squadrons given bombers would return home due to technical problems and not drop their bombs over the target area. So let's have a look at what's happening on the ground in Wuppertal itself. The air raid sirens start going off around 10:30 to 11 p.m. that night. This is nothing unusual at that point in the war. Air raid sirens went off most nights, but then there's also announcements on the radio that an air raid is expected over Wuppertal. So German radar and air defences have obviously worked out from a fairly early stage in the proceedings what the target actually is. Now, bear in mind that Wuppertal hadn't really been a target before, so nobody there really knows what to expect, although other towns in the surrounding vicinity had been bombed heavily. So let's meet a few of the citizens of Wuppertal who are out and about that evening. First of all, we meet 21-year-old Marlisa Burris and her friends, who are enjoying an evening at the theatre and are just beginning to head home when the first bombs begin falling, just as our two crews are taking off from RAF Melbourne. We also meet widowed grandmother, Mrs. Elizabeth Stooting. Now, she's visiting a friend in the neighbouring street, Paulstrasse, and when the air raid warning comes, she decides to stay put and shelter with her friend, rather than attempt to get back to her home in Bahnhofstrasse, which I think translates roughly as Station Road. The local GP, Dr. Elizabeth Stark, has been on duty all evening, And as soon as she hears the warning, instead of returning home, she heads for the town hall, which is one of the designated emergency centres. Now, she's obviously expecting a very busy night. Now, the accounts from Fräulein Bruce and Dr. Stark appear in their original German in a book called Vor 50 Jahren, Bomben auf Wuppertal, published in 1993 for the 50th anniversary of the raid. And the accounts have kindly been translated for us by Ian McNee.
Aboard Y Yorker and S Sugar, the Pennycott and Clark crews are approaching the target area. Shortly after passing over the Dutch coast, they can already see the distant orange glow of fires on the horizon. This is signifying that many of those ahead of them in the bomber stream have already hit their targets and are heading for home. And then it begins. Suddenly and without warning, the sweep of searchlight beams scanning the sky for invaders and the incessant noise of flak and anti-aircraft cannon shells exploding all around them. From silence to chaos in an instant. Tom Sayer, a Halifax pilot with 106 Squadron at the next door base to Melbourne, Pocklington, also took part in the raid on Wuppertal. Tom had joined the RAF as an apprentice before the war and had trained with the United States Army Air Force, USAAF. He flew Blenheims initially before moving on to Halifax's. It was bloody awful, to put it mildly, he recalled. There was so much anti-aircraft fire approaching the River Valley, we could have got out of the aircraft and walked on it. As well as the threat of flak and anti-aircraft fire, the German night fighters were also lying in wait for them. Some bomber pilots adopted avoidance tactics, bobbing and weaving around to avoid the fire of the Nazi defenders, but not Tom. I wasn't one for weaving around. It endangered nearby aircraft in the bomber stream, and it also took longer to reach the target. Best way was to just fly straight through it. For Tom, the hardest thing to deal with was seeing other aircraft being hit all around him, some exploding instantly, others falling out of the sky, leaving a trail of thick black smoke and flaming debris behind them. He remembered the ground crew seeking him out the morning after the Wuppertal raid to ascertain the health of his crew, because there were so many holes at the front of the aircraft where they had been sitting.
Now, by the time the Pennycott crew in Y Yorker are approaching their target in the Barman district of the town, at around 1:15 in the morning, Wuppertal is already well alight. Although the Pathfinder aircraft had marked the targets with yellow flares, then red, then green, with the bomber crews having received instructions to aim for the red and green target indicators, in reality, the extent of the bombing was such that some of the flare markers were just not visible and certainly not necessary. Now, on the ground, our local GP, Elizabeth Stark, actually sees the Pathfinder flares coming in, and she then describes what happens next. At about 11 p.m, the air raid alarm sounded permanently, and on the radio came the message that there was an air raid expected over Wuppertal. I quickly drove to the emergency centre in the town hall. I didn't even have time to close the main door of the town hall before I saw the Christmas trees, which marked the target for the bombers. At the same time, hundreds of bombers flew over Wuppertal Barmen and started dumping their deadly load of bombs, incendiary devices and phosphorus canisters on the town. My car, which I'd parked in front of the building, caught fire immediately. The roof of the town hall was on fire. At the last minute, the two schoolchildren who acted as messengers when the telephones failed were rescued from the second floor. We all fled to the air raid shelter in the cellar and started praying. The bombing was endless. The town hall was on fire, and then I gave the order to get out and try to reach the next emergency centre, which was about 500 metres away. We collected as many medical supplies as we could and tried to get out, but every exit was blocked by burning material. We eventually broke a window and escaped through that. Everywhere it was burning. The houses that had not been destroyed by the bombs were on fire due to the incendiary devices and the phosphorus bombs, which prevented us from getting to the next centre. A strong wind came up, which produced a firestorm. Barely 300 metres away, the birth clinic had received a direct hit, although it had had a large red cross painted on its roof, and 30 mothers with their newborn babies perished in the flames.
Meanwhile, the 10 Squadron crews, it's incredible, really, isn't it? Listening to this, it's just, you can't even begin to imagine it. And meanwhile, the 10 Squadron crews are approaching the target. On board Y Yorker, the Pennycott crew are preparing to make their bombing run. lining up the aircraft at the right height and speed to be able to drop their bombs on the correct coordinates. The sky around them is lit up almost like daylight. Ken Cox lying in the front in the bomb aimer's position has the best view of all the carnage on the ground. Poor Jack Clyde in his little wireless operator's cubbyhole under the pilot's position can't see anything. Maybe that's just as well. In the rear gunner's position, Bill Bradshaw can see only the arching searchlight, smoke, and the seemingly endless procession of aircraft above, below, and behind him. 15 miles short of the target, which isn't very far at all when you're flying at 260 miles per hour, Wyorka flew into a flak barrage. An explosion of flak hit the upper gun turret, blowing out the perspex windows and causing the entire aircraft to shudder and vibrate. The temperature on board nosedived as ice-cold air poured in. Although he had a few cuts to his face, Freddie Singh, our Australian mid-upper gunner, escapes major injury, but crucially, the mid-upper gunner's turret is rendered useless. This means Wyorka has little means of defence against aerial attack other than Bill Bradshaw and his machine guns at the rear. If they are to be attacked by a night fighter from the front, the Pennycock crew have more or less had it. It's too late to abandon the mission, though. They're too close to the target. Literally seconds away by now. The noise from the engines, the thud crump of exploding shells, and the vibration of the airframe as it is struck repeatedly by flak must be utterly unbearable. That the crew would have to endure this a further 29 times is almost beyond their comprehension. Jack, the wireless operator, who is from a mining town in the northeast of England, is so frightened he starts singing the Geordie folk song, The Bladen Races, to keep his spirits up and to try and remain focused. A song his late mother used to sing to him when he was a little boy.
If things aren't already going badly enough for the Pennycott crew, the voice of Roy Tan, the navigator, comes over the intercom, informing the rest of the crew that his instruments have failed and that the compass has been knocked out. All their navigation systems have been damaged and are useless. Almost immediately, Ken Cox shouts, "Bomb's gone." As Pennycott begins to pull away from the target, the Barman district is a mass of flames. The whole of Wuppertal seems to be on fire. One pilot recalled, just after dropping his bombs and heading for home, two enormous explosions with flames 800 feet in the air, followed by massive smoke clouds which glowed red, lit from within by the flames below. 200 tons of explosives are being dropped, and the onslaught of high explosive and incendiaries fanned by the winds that blew down the Wupper Valley had caused a firestorm, just like those in Coventry and Lubeck. One fire alone spread over 3 square miles. Now, if Penny Sprangers think that the worst of it is over as they wheel away from their target, they couldn't be more wrong. They face intense flak defences on the return trip, especially as their route home takes them over the heavily defended cities of Dusseldorf, Essen and Gelsenkirchen. There's a continuous belt of searchlights from Cologne at the southern end of the Ruhr to Dortmund in the north. And the night fighters of the Luftwaffe, Messerschmitts mainly, are patrolling the route, picking off the Halifaxes and the Lancasters as they try to make for home. I think there's a statistic somewhere that most aircraft shot down over target areas are actually turning for home and have already dropped their bombs and are sort of beginning their return leg, if you like, when they get picked off.
Yeah. Well, they have to fly straight and level for the photograph to snap as well. So that makes it even more of a sitting duck. I think they're still for, I think it's about a minute, but that's an eternity.
Yeah. It must seem
in
like
that situation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as Wyorka approached Aachen, she's hit again, this time by a cannon shell from a German aircraft, which has been stalking her for some miles. Without her upper gun turret in operation, Wyorka is pretty much powerless to defend herself. In his tail gunner's position, Bill Bradshaw can't see the enemy aircraft approaching. And with the upper turret's windows already have been lost on the approach to Wuppertal, the noise of cannon fire and flak shells exploding all around, it's virtually impossible for the crew to communicate with each other. Now, it's at this point that flight engineer George Phillipson starts yelling, "Port outer, port outer," referring to the outermost engine on the left-hand side of the aircraft, which has been hit and is now on fire. So the crew are utterly terrified and facing the possibility that they're going to have to bail out. Featherport outer, George is yelling. The pilot, Pennicott, begins to take the aircraft into a steep descent towards the very anti-aircraft defences which are trying to destroy them, to try and extinguish the fire. With only three operational engines, a gaping hole in the upper gun turret, an interior temperature well below zero, an injured crewman, and no working compass on navigation system, Penny's prangers are really pretty much in really dire straits now.
Penny knows the lives of his crew now depend upon his skills as a pilot and upon Roy's abilities to somehow find their way home in the midst of this hell on earth using the old-fashioned methods of navigation, maps, pocket compass, sextant, visual landmarks, and the star bearings from the astroglobe positioned at above his head. Although there's a large compass just in front of Penny's knees, it's useless if he has no idea where he is in this in the first place. And he urgently needs Roy to give him a bearing to follow. This would have been difficult at the very best of times, let alone in the dead of night, in a badly damaged aircraft, was under heavy fire in cloudy weather. Yorker makes for the less populated and less well-defended Dutch border. They're praying that they don't get caught by a searchlight as they make their escape. To be coned at this point, at the height of which they are forced to fly, would have meant certain death. As they pass over the Dutch coast, Roy is able to work out roughly where they are and quickly provides a route to West Malling, the nearest base on the English coast. There's absolutely no prospect of them being able to get back to Yorkshire as they've lost a lot of fuel and the aircraft is too badly damaged. Plus, there's a heavy fog at Melbourne anyway, so the returning aircraft are being told to disperse. If anything else goes wrong, if any more equipment fails, or if they come under attack again, Penny will have to ditch his aircraft in the North Sea. The chances of rescue would be very slim indeed. At around 4 o'clock in the morning, just as Yorker is about to make landfall over the Kent coast, the sudden thud-thud of anti-aircraft fire is unmistakable. They're now being attacked by naval guns. Friendly fire as they come over the Kent coast. But fortunately make it to West Malling without further damage.
So Penny and his crew finally touch down at the Kent Air Base at about 4:15 in the morning. They've been gone just 5.25 hours. And in that time, thousands of German civilians have lost their lives. 33 Bomber Command aircraft and their crews have been lost on the raid. And it's believed 22 of those were shot down by night fighters. From a military point of view, the raid is considered a huge success. There's 113 factory premises were damaged or destroyed, including two which apparently made fabric for parachutes for the Luftwaffe. But the human cost is immense and there are huge numbers of casualties. Now, the best figures available, it's estimated that around 3,400 people died that night, most of them burned to death in the firestorm. And such was the intensity of the fires that there was often very little left in the way of human remains. So it is difficult to get an exact figure. A further 2,500 are believed to have been injured, but almost 120,000 people are made homeless that night. That's incredible, isn't it? And more still would die the next day during the rescue effort. You remember Tom Sayer, our pilot from Pocklington, and several of his crews, had dropped bombs with time delay switches, primed to explode some 6, 9 or even 12 hours after the initial bombardment. When I spoke to Tom about 6 or 7 years ago, he confessed that he'd always found that very, very difficult to deal with. Even 75 years later, it was obviously still on his conscience. And it really continued to trouble him. Now, you'll remember Mrs. Stooting, our grandmother, who'd been visiting her friend on the night of the raid. Now, I actually interviewed her granddaughter, Heilgard Hacker, about 4 years ago. Five-year-old Heilgard, her eldest sister, Voltraud, and her parents were away from Wuppertal at the time of the raid in East Prussia. Her father was stationed there with the Wehrmacht. I think he must have been quite senior, being able to take his family with him. So he must have been a senior officer. Now, they first heard of the disaster which had befallen their hometown when they got a telegram a couple of days later to inform them that her father's mother had been killed. Now, I'll let Heilgard pick up the story and explain what happened. So these are her own words from the interview that she gave. I was too young to know what that meant, and I couldn't understand why Valtraud, who was 7 years older than me, was crying most of the time. My father received compassionate leave, and the family set out for Wuppertal. Valtraud and I were left with an aunt in Berlin, and my parents continued on to Wuppertal. On the evening of the 29th of May, my grandmother, Elizabeth Stooting, had been visiting her friend who lived in Paulstrasse. Whether she intended to stay overnight or go back home later, nobody knows. But when the air raid siren sounded, she was still there. All of the house occupants went down to the washroom in the cellar, which served as an air raid shelter in the majority of houses. That street received several direct hits, and everyone in the cellar was killed. The next day, rescuers found them all crouched together in the cellar where the firestorm had taken them. Their bodies were only half their normal size and absolutely unrecognisable. The only way my grandmother could be identified was by the contents of her handbag, which was laying beside her body. She was originally buried in an anonymous grave, but as my parents were able to identify her belongings, her grave was given a headstone, which still exists in Barmen Cemetery today. The irony of it all is that my grandmother's own house in Bahnhofstrasse survived the air raid unscathed. God, that's just
Jack Clyde.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Absolutely unbelievable.
Listening to that. Yeah. And this is the thing. You've got to talk about what's happening on the ground with these. And it is very, very difficult, especially when you read about the bodies being half the size and the way that people were identified. In this case, it was the handbag. And the fact that the home was unscathed is just, yeah.
Absolutely tragic and utterly horrific.
Yeah. So we'll return with Jack of the Pennycock crew. He recorded the following brief entry in his logbook. Intense AA fire and searchlights encountered. Compass US on return. Landed at West Malling. The figure 1 appears in red ink next to the entry to signify this was his first operation. And that was it. No further details were given. No hint of the ordeal the crew had encountered, nor of their miraculous survival. A few days later, Jack pasted beneath his entry a newspaper cutting, which included a photograph of the Wuppertal firestorm as seen from the air. The caption read, "First Blitz on Wuppertal, a picture that gives evidence of the concentrated nature of the attack. Each bubble of light is an incendiary bomb burning, the larger blobs indicating where fires are already beginning to develop." There is no reference in the article to the horror of which had unfolded on the ground. And we'll make sure to post a copy of that entry from Jack's logbook on our social media channels. The station operations book entry, compiled from Penny's report of their mission, gives a few further details. Bombed primary target at 0120 hours from 19,000 feet on red-green marker flares. Visibility was poor, but a good number of fires were observed in the target area. Results of own bombing were not seen. Little opposition was experienced at the target. I mean, can you believe that's what was written down?
Really?
Yeah. Goodness me. And it continues. Aircraft landed at West Malling. Aircraft was caught in a flak barrage 50 miles short of target, and Compass G were rendered US. Perspex panels were blown out of mid-turret and a hole made in the cowling of port outer engine. And that's it. And now that we focus a lot on Pennycott's crew of 10 Squadron, what of the other rookie crew, that of New Zealander Clark in S. Sugar?
At RAF Melbourne, the stand usually occupied by Halifax SDT 787 S Sugar, flown by Flight Sergeant Clark and his crew, remained empty. You'll remember that S Sugar had taken off directly behind Y Yorker the preceding night. The Squadron Operations Book entry simply states, "This aircraft failed to return from its mission, no message being received from it after it left base." Clark and his crew were believed to have been shot down over the target area and crashed nearby. There were no survivors. They are buried together in a collective grave at the Reichswald War Cemetery. God, that's hard going, isn't it? Their first op.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely horrendous. Yeah. So I think this is one of the first raids where we actually have such mass casualties occurring because of the firestorm. But this is it's a deliberate tactic by the RAF, isn't it? This is what they are trying to achieve.
Yeah. I mean, they've seen, you mentioned raids earlier, so the firestorms happen, they're designed to happen. It causes maximum destruction. It also causes maximum chaos to the emergency services on the ground, and adding that, the time-delayed bombs. It's ongoing. It really, really is.
And this is going on night after night after night, just in different cities, sometimes in the same cities, and it's just... I just can't even begin to grasp that, really. Can't.
No, sorry. I was just going to say that this is all really summing up the escalation or slow escalation of the bombing campaign in general. You're caught more or less in the middle now, where the figures are slowly rising till you get to the tens of thousands. You look at Hamburg, July 43. It just suddenly goes into overdrive with these new tactics. That's all I was going to say.
And that's about 6 weeks after that. That's not very long after this at all. This is end of May, and Hamburg's early mid July.
Yeah.
There's something like 40,000 people over the two nights, something like that.
Yeah.
Is it that many?
Yeah, I think it's about 45,000.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. You can't even wrap your head around those sorts of figures and that sort of destruction.
No, as a
deliberate tactic, really. No. And this is actually discussed in the Bomber Command War Diaries by Martin Middlebrook and Chris Ward, who describe it as the outstanding success of the Battle of the Ruhr. So the Pathfinder marking and the main force bombing was apparently particularly accurate that night, and a large fire area developed in the narrow streets of the old centre of the town. Lots of these German cities have an old town, an Altstadt, if you like, which are full of medieval and wooden buildings, basically. So as soon as the incendiary bombs start falling, that's it. The whole lot just goes up. And because it's a Saturday night, many of the town's area officials are away at their country homes for the weekend. And the fire services of the town are dealing with their first raid, and they're just not able to cope. I mean, how could you possibly even begin to cope with that? So approximately 1,000 acres, which is about 80% of the Barmen district of the town, is actually destroyed. The number of industrial and domestic premises destroyed was more than twice that as in any previous raid. The number of people killed was about five times greater. It's just a massive escalation, isn't it? Now, I discussed the raid with the tail gunner of the Penicott crew, Bill Bradshaw, a couple of years ago. And you know something? Even after all this time, he still found it difficult to talk about it, and that was what, nearly 80 years later. And I was sitting there chatting to him, and his daughter went to get his logbook, but he wouldn't look at it, and even now he still couldn't look at his logbook after all this time. He just found it too traumatic, which that was really quite upsetting, actually.
And there are many that never talk about it or talk about it very late in life.
Well, like Tom Davidson, who we interviewed a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, I mean, Tom was in his early 90s before he felt able to talk about it, and he said once he started talking about it, he just couldn't stop. It was as if all those sort of thoughts and feelings had been bottled up for 70 odd years or whatever, and it just all came out. And I think I hope he finds it of some benefit being able to actually talk about it and to discuss it.
Well, let's remind ourselves that the outstanding success of the Battle of the Ruhr, what it looked like to the German civilians on the ground. And you'll remember Marlies Burris on the way to home from the theatre with her friends when the bombs started falling. She gave this account of what they witnessed. All of a sudden, a small boy appeared before us. He was naked and had multiple burns, which he couldn't feel anymore. He had a bird cage in his hand. I couldn't identify the bird as it was burned to a crisp. We couldn't help him, and in the next moment, the gavel end of a house fell on him and put him out of his misery. He didn't even cry out. I can still envisage him, even today.
And that's the reality of strategic bombing. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.